open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I want you to start the book, you know, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. I'm just gonna read 15, 20 minutes and go to bed. 4 in the morning, you're cursing at me.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, mystery and thriller writer Harlan Coben. He says a writer needs three things: inspiration, perspiration, and the most important, desperation.
I was on a panel once with a bunch of writers, and we were asked, if you weren't a writer, what would you be? And one of my friends says, a United States senator. I'm like, oh, please. I'd be a duvet cover. This is all I can do.
Harlan Coben publishes one book a year, and he's debuted at the top of the New York Times bestseller list 7 times. His novel, Tell No One, was made into a French film of the same name. Coben's latest novel is The Stranger. To start off the evening's event at the City Opera House, Traverse City Mayor Michael Estes presented Harlan Coben with a key to the city. I began our conversation telling Coben he's had quite a year.
You just came back from France, where you had the premiere of a television show.
Yeah.
The Stranger was published earlier this spring. The mayor of Paris awarded you a Medal of Honor in Arts and Letters. You won an award in Spain.
Mayor of Traverse City just awarded me one, too.
Hey, man, don't step on my line. Okay, I'm kidding.
Sorry. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
it really
you.
Has been a couple
Thrilled
of years
to be
in
here.
The making.
Thank you.
And I'm thrilled. I've been a fan of yours since the 90s, reading the early Myron Bullock.
When you were a wee child.
I was. Well.
There we go.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I think we were a wee together, but me in Michigan, you in New Jersey. Where you grew up in Livingston? Born
in Newark, grew up in Livingston.
Right.
Yeah.
And your father was a lawyer.
Yep.
And, you know, you talk, in thinking about you, you talk about growing up and how your father was a lawyer, and you were on people that worked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And as the mayor just referenced, you'd work a lot. I mean, you must work a lot to write that many books. And I really admire your work ethic.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the world of Harlan Coben on a daily basis in New Jersey, where you live now, with your wife, Dr. Armstrong, and who's got what sounds like a really fascinating career.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you guys juggle?
One of us had to have a real job in this relationship. Because when I started writing, I'd been in the family business, and I lost that job when the family business was sold under strange circumstances. And thank goodness I had married a pediatrician so that I had somebody who could support me in the style to which I've become accustomed. As I began to dabble in this hobby of trying to write, and I think most women probably would have pushed me to get another job, or spouse would have pushed the spouse to get another job right away.
Right.
But I had this delusion, actually. You know, our first child was born in 94, and I actually had this thinking that I would actually write while my daughter sat quietly in the corner. All the parents here are laughing at my delusional idea that would be how I would start off writing.
And in 94, Charlotte?
Yes, Charlotte.
Is born. Yeah. So the family business was a travel agency, right, that your grandfather had started. And you went to Spain, actually, in your senior year of college. And then ended up writing a first novel after that experience?
Well, I was, during summers while I was in college, my summer job was to work in the Costa del Sol of Spain as a tour guide for Americans visiting. Not because I'm a great linguist, but my grandfather ran the travel agency, nepotism, pure and simple. And I was really bad at it, for one thing. I didn't speak Spanish, and Americans were so demanding on vacation in those days. Like, we would go traveling we'd be driving like 6 hours through the back country, and we'd get there, and one of my clients would say, 3 hours ago, I was looking through binoculars, and I saw a small church in the distance. What's the name of that church? And expect you to know it. You know, so I would go like, San Maria del Almuerzo, which means St. Mary of Lunch. I just make stuff up. And so I decided why not make stuff up? And so I actually decided to write a book about the experience, and I did. So that was my first novel.
But then the business was sold. I'm kind of figuring out why.
Shock, wasn't it?
Well, you graduated from Amherst College in Western Massachusetts in 1984.
Yep.
and lived with your parents for like 4 years after that, 1988. Is this because you're working with your grandfather? And
yeah, it was just cheaper. I couldn't afford to get a place yet. Anne was going to medical school. We had been dating since I was a sophomore, and she was a freshman. She seduced me quite young. I was young and naive, and she was the big bad wolf who, no. no. While she was going to medical school, I lived at home in my old bedroom, which I guess now is not that uncommon. Back then it was now it's very common, but back then it was sort of unheard of, yeah. So I was living in my parents' house, and my mom really ran the company. My grandfather was the name, but my mom really ran the company, so my mom and I would go to work together each morning.
That's interesting. How did you feel living in your
parents'
bedroom?
Oh, God, I hated it. No, I mean, what I realized from having a job is that I wasn't really meant to hold a job. I'm not really good. It's no offense. But I often say there's three things that make a writer, and you know this, Doug, because you are a writer. But there's three things that make it. Two are obvious, and the third is not so obvious. The two that are obvious, the first one is inspiration. Well, duh, we have to be inspired to work, and that's part of it. Second is perspiration, and that's actually doing the work of writing, and that's just writing. Everything else is flotsam and jetsam. By writing, I mean writing. I don't mean creating characters is not writing, doing outlines is not writing, hanging with your friends at Starbucks is not writing, talking about writing is not writing, research is not writing. Only writing is writing. Only those moments you're actually in a chair, your butt's in a chair, you are putting words on paper or a screen, that's all that counts as writing. Okay, so we have inspiration and we have perspiration, but the third and probably most important is desperation.
Yeah.
And that is, I'm not fit to do anything else. Like hold a real job.
Yeah.
I was on a panel once with a bunch of writers, and we were asked, we get this question, you get this question a lot too. If you weren't a writer, what would you be? And one of my friends says, a United States senator. I'm like, oh, please. I'd be a duvet cover. This is all I can do. I have no marketable skills. I'm disorganized. My wife's nodding somewhere in the dark right now. You know, I forget things. I dress like this because I can. You know, it's like I'm always.
Match, by the way?
No, I don't think so.
No, what's the other one?
I don't know.
Oh, they do. Yeah.
Oh, they do. They're both the same.
Yeah.
I don't think they match anything else, but they clash with the world. But so that desperation, I think, is one of the things that makes you want to write. That you're really not fit to do anything else, at least in my case.
So you were did you have posters like of Journey and Foreigner on your bedroom wall from leftover from, I can just imagine that summer, because Amherst is an intense place. You had some interesting classmates there, Dan Brown, David Foster Wallace, I'm probably forgetting a couple people.
Yeah, Mark Costello, who wrote The Big Ifs, Bill Amon, who does Foxtrot comics, Susanna Grant, who wrote Aaron Brovokovich and a bunch of other movies. We were all there at the same, Chris Kojalian, who wrote Midwives. We were all there between 82 and 86. All of us were there.
And then I was just down the road at that same time at Hampshire College.
At Hampshire.
Which had no grades.
That was a funky place.
Yeah, yeah. And no requirements. And yeah.
We took a class there, and we were the only people who didn't wear hemp to class. Yeah. And we didn't smell like weed completely.
You wore the hemp? Yeah.
I did, but someone started smoking my arm. It was like, it was one of those sort of things.
No, I would hitchhike from the corner there and on Route 116 back to Hampshire.
All right.
And think, wow, Amherst looks so cool. I took a couple classes there.
Yeah.
But you know, it's so funny to think of your classmates at that time. I mean, because you weren't a lit major.
No.
You were on a basketball scholarship. You played forward
on basketball. They don't do Division III, but yeah, I got in because I was a basketball player. I was terrified that I wouldn't be able to handle the academics I had gotten in because of my...
And Anne, your wife is on the team,
both,
the women's
both
team.
Of us, we were on the same team, but yeah, my wife and I are... she's better than I am. We actually both were...
It was a co-ed basketball team?
No, it wasn't, unfortunately. But we were members of a co-ed fraternity. Don't ask me how, it's too confusing to explain. But it wasn't all male school. When it turned co-ed, they sued and made it our fraternity's co-ed. So I'm one of the few guys who many years ago was able to marry my fraternity brother. Before it was really in fashion, I was able to marry my fraternity brother.
I'm shocked she married you after the stories you've told already in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm in trouble.
But it's turned out really well since then. Was there a moment that, you know, growing up, I've heard that you were inspired by Narnia, you liked the Marathon Man. Did you ever meet William Goldman, the author
of
that?
I have met him. We became very, actually friends. One of the books I often list as an influence, when I was 16 years old, my father gave me my first adult thriller, which was William Goldman's Marathon Man. If you haven't read it, don't leave right now, but as soon as we're done. I'm sure, I haven't read it in a while, it still holds up, and I remember reading this book, and at the time I had no idea I wanted to be a writer, but subconsciously I was just like, you could put a gun to my head and I couldn't put the book down, and I know subconsciously I was thinking, how cool must it be to be William Goldman and be able to make people feel this way? And so when somebody says that to me, I get a tingle. Many years later, I got to meet William Goldman. We had dinner at his house. I went to a basketball game with him. He's a long-suffering Knicks fan. It's very sad for Bill. A great guy, and he had read some of the articles. And he was like, well, I don't get it. Why'd you like that book so much? I don't know. But he was very flattered by it. It was really cool to talk to him about it. His whole career has been fascinating. For those who don't know, he also wrote both the books and a movie for Princess Bride. He wrote All the President's Men. He wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He wrote in the best book, Adventures of Screenwriting, the best books ever written on the movie industry, where he says nobody knows anything is the cardinal rule.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So tell us what we know, or what you know, about the world of the Harlan Coben novel. I have a couple of ideas, but tell us what The Stranger...
You tell me. I'm kind of curious.
No. Okay.
Go ahead.
The Stranger, the new book, what's it about?
400-something pages, I think. The Stranger's a guy who comes into your life and drops a bomb. The book opens up, a man named Adam is just hanging out at the American Legion Hall. He's picking his son's lacrosse team, and all of a sudden the stranger comes in, says a few words to him, and his entire life explodes. And we'll see the stranger periodically in the book go to people, whisper a little something in their ear, and their whole life explodes in different ways. And it was more about the secrets, what we use the internet for, and all of those sort of things. But always my books are about heart, I'm hoping. About family, how tenuous that is, how important it is. Because I think we all get that. I mean, mm-hmm. We all get the importance of that sort of thing, and it's something that makes all of our hearts pound.
Right, and I think women, I think women form a large portion of your readership.
Yeah.
Because their books, they are ostensibly thrillers, but to me, they're really about the power of having a secret and the vulnerability of having that secret exposed.
Yeah.
And I think you write better than anybody about the secrets of the suburban life and about typically people trying to protect their families. You know, it's interesting, and the internet mm-hmm. always figures, it seems, in your books. I just want to ask you about that. Stuff comes into people's lives via the digital.
Right.
Tunnel, and why is that a fascination you had early on? Or?
Not really. I mean, and I don't have any technological skills. Just the world we live in. You know, it's like, do you remember those old? You watch those old movies. You would watch, and you'd see the person desperately calling the house, and you'd see the phone ring. Answer it, damn it, answer it. No one would answer it. That's not realistic anymore. All of us have cell phones, and so if any of you are going out on a date tonight, you're going to Google that person's name before you go. That's just normal now. So to not reflect that, it would be like writing about the 1970s and right. having no reference to the Vietnam War. It's just there.
Right.
It's just part of our world. And there's both advantages and disadvantages in terms of being an author to any technology, but my books take place in the present day. Right. So, you know, all of you probably have an iPhone or some kind of phone on you. All of you can, as soon as you leave here, check to see what you got email-wise, even though there's never anything important. It used to be like, remember how you used to love waiting for the mail to come? And you're like, well, the mail's here, like, and nothing ever came in the mail. That was exciting. Now we do that with email. It's just reflecting what's reality now.
Yeah. There's some three sentences that start the books, if I could. Gone for Good, published in 2002. First yep. sentence of the novel. You know what it is?
No.
I'm fair.
I mean, I know what it's about, but I don't remember the exact line.
I'm going to ask you another
some
question.
Some I will know, but not
okay.
that one.
3 days before her death, my mother told me, these weren't her last words, but they were pretty close, that my brother was still alive. Novel Long Lost, published in 2009, a Myron Bolitar novel, by the way. You don't know her secret, Wynne said to me, that is me being Myron. Should I, said Myron. Wynne shrugged. It's bad, I asked. Very, said Wynne. Then maybe I don't want to know. And then Livewire, another Myron Boulatard novel, 2011, begins, these are all first sentences, "The ugliest truth, a friend once told Myron, is still better than the prettiest of lies." And it's so interesting, knowing you now a little bit, Harlan, you have such a, I think, interesting, healthy outlook on the world, but these three sentences are really about what it's like to have a secret, or the fear that what I'm seeing is not really the thing that's true. And that seems to be where you live kind of as a writer, and that's the tension of your books.
I mean, I think there's something to that. I mean, it's also just that I really want to grab you right away. I want to grab you in the first line, and I challenge myself to that. Another one that I always remember, No Second Chance, the whole idea of the book started with the first sentence popped into my head. I don't know why, just the first sentence was, "When the first bullet hit my chest, I thought of my daughter." Just that sentence popped. Well, why, where? I just did a whole story around that first sentence. And so part of it is always a challenge to me, is that I don't want to wait 10 pages of a sunset, describing the sunset, to get you involved in the book. I want you to start the book, you know, it's 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, I'm just gonna read 15, 20 minutes and go to bed. 4 in the morning, you're cursing at me. Thank you.
Yeah. They're cursing right now,
that's right.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was walking in, a nice lady stopped me and said, "Oh, I'm almost done with The Stranger." I'm like, "And you could put it down to come here tonight?" It's like a little hurt, you know. So that's always what I'm aiming to do. And I write with that kind of energy. I write every page, every paragraph, every sentence, every word. I try to ask myself, is this compelling? Is this gripping? Is this moving the story forward? It doesn't mean you can't have descriptions. You have to. It doesn't mean you can't have themes. Those are hugely important. But it means that everything has to be slave to that sort of desire to really want to make sure that I'm not letting you off that hook, that I am really keeping you gripped, and that you are entertained and enlightened and moved as much as I can do it.
Right. You say each book begins with a question.
Yeah.
Sometimes you might pose that question by spending 3 months on the couch.
Right.
Staring at the ceiling.
Yes.
What was the question that began The Stranger?
I don't remember. Well, I was just thinking about we do a lot of things online that we think are anonymous, and of course they're not. You know, what if somebody started to reveal those, both good things and bad things? I mean, what if we had that sort of openness? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And then going from there. How
right.
do I blow up somebody? I do suburbia. One of the reasons I love to do mostly suburbia or normal lives is because in a very placid, quiet lake, which is not your lake right now, by the way. We were on it yesterday. It was not. But normally, in Norton's quiet, placid lake, one pebble can really cause reverberations. I don't like great evil. I don't really write about serial killers who hack up people for no reason. That bores me. Or, Ed Harris in none of my movies ever going to be calling the president at the last moment saying, get the nukes ready. That's just not what I do. I prefer that sort of small, quiet thing, and a small explosion can really reverberate.
Right. I think, you write so fascinatingly about the nicest kinds of people getting into the worst kinds of trouble.
Yeah. That's
And what kind of trouble do you get in?
Pretty much none. I mean, my normal life, and I don't use the word boring, I guess I should use the word normal, but, wow, what's it like to be a writer? Well, in the morning I wake up, then we get the kids up, right? Get the kids out to school. It's just very, very normal. I live in a suburban town. One kid has lacrosse practice, the other one has dance lessons or whatever else. It's my normal existence is really normal. And I don't really, people think you must have great fears and things like that. I don't. I think I get them all out in the books. It's almost like therapy where I put them all out, and I think I'm actually fairly chill. You can ask my kids later on as a dad. I think I'm fairly chill.
Right. Right.
I'm embarrassing and annoying, but I'm fairly chill.
Who's your reader? Do you read aloud to the family ever?
Do I?
Read your books aloud. When you're working, what's your process?
Do you get up? Well, Anne's been my first reader most of my career. Nowadays, a little bit more the age. People don't really read me too often while I'm writing. By contract, I think it is, I'm really supposed to send my editor, and also to keep them calm, so don't get nervous, I send them like the first 100 pages of the book. And my editor's job is to just tell me it's brilliant, even if it's not. Oh my God, this is genius. It's great. My wife too. Because I'm like every other writer I know, I'm horrendously insecure. So like, you know, I remember, you know, one time my wife was like, you know, you accidentally typed the word the twice in a row. I'm like, oh my God, the whole thing stinks. You're just being nice. This is your way of being. So, you know, all I want to hear is that it's great, so I keep going.
Right.
You have to really give, one of the hardest part about being a writer, if you're out there and you're trying to learn to write, is to get out of your own way and not hate yourself while you're writing, is to turn off that horrible editor who's saying to you, every word I write stinks, and just get past it. I compare sometimes the first to diamond mining. You know, if you're diamond mining, you go into this dirt and you pull out this really ugly stone, and then you know, the second or third drafts is shaping into something you want to wear. And too often, as a novelist, we're trying to look for the perfect stone in the ground that doesn't exist. You have to give yourself permission to have the first draft stink, because you're going to improve it later on. That's part of it, just getting those words down. Anything that will help me get that first draft down, turning off that voice and not worrying about it is really good for me.
How do you do that, though? How do you turn off that voice?
I don't know. It's a struggle every day, frankly. You know, but that's the one thing I've learned with experience is don't reread now and don't worry if it stinks. There's days, and I know you have this too, Doug, there's days I'm writing when the muse is kind of kind and the words are actually kind of flowing. And there's days I'm writing like every word is a case of constipation that could kill a horse. You know, it's just a struggle and it stinks. Or there's times I'm wide awake and there's times I'm writing, it's too late at night, I'm too tired. And when I look at this book now, I can't tell you what I wrote in the good days and what I wrote in the bad days.
Right.
You know, I can't tell you what day I was in a bad mood or what day I was in a good mood, what day I didn't feel like writing. If you can get it down, you can then, every writer that we know, right? You rewrite,
yeah.
Right? Every writer we know rewrites. Rewrites a lot. Except that one guy, but we don't hang out with him. You know what I mean? He's that guy. Every other writer that I know rewrites a lot. So the thing I keep telling myself is don't worry. You know it's going to be better once you clean it up and fix it. Just get the story down. Then you can add exactly what the person is wearing. Then you can make sure that metaphor, that simile, and that analogy, those things are all working beautifully. Just get it down.
When do you do the rewriting? After the draft is done?
No, I do it as I'm writing. So I don't really write like this in a straight line. I kind of write like this, where each day I go back and I rewrite what I wrote the day before, almost to get like a running start. And then every 75 pages or so, I go all the way back to the beginning and I rewrite the whole thing. By the time I finish a book, chapter one, by the time I finish the first draft, if you will, chapter one has probably been rewritten 8 to 10 times already.
Right.
And so my draft when I finish is already pretty clean. The other thing that I do most of the time, and I say most of the time because I do whatever works, I change up, but most of the time I try to write on paper for about 10 or 15 pages and then I put it on the computer. The reason for this is, one, there's something childlike and freeing for me about pen to paper. I can go like this, I can make arrows, I can cross out. When you delete on a computer, it feels gone forever. But these you can kind of do and move around. Second, I don't count them as done pages till I put them on my computer. So my first draft is already my second draft. So those are some of the things I try to do.
Will you draft in paper all the time, like that, every day, or just to get
most
going?
Most of the time.
It's a trick.
You know what? I do whatever works. I don't know how you, do you have an office, Doug?
No, I have the kitchen table.
You have the kitchen table. Is that like some writers, and you know you've interviewed a lot, like have to have the one spot, they wear that clothing or whatever. I'm the opposite. I can work any place until it stops working, and then I go somewhere else. It's like riding the horse dies, and then I look for another horse to jump on. So if writing at 8 in the morning is working, I do that. If writing at 11 o'clock at night is working, I do that. If writing, for a while, two books ago, I was writing at a coffee shop located next to the deli counter inside a supermarket. It smelled like hell, but it was working. And last book, The Stranger, I was sort of getting stuck at the end. And one day I took, do you guys have Uber here yet? Do you have Uber?
No.
A taxi service. So I took an Uber car into New York because I didn't feel like driving and the parking was going to be hell. But I felt so guilty about spending the money on Uber. I was sitting in the back seat. I started to write. And I wrote really well. So I started taking Ubers everywhere. So it's really whatever works, man. Whatever gets you to write, that's the secret. What do you do? If it gets you to write, write. And when it stops working, I change up. Sometimes I write really well on airplanes, so all of a sudden I'm encouraging air travel. I hate traveling by airplane, but if it's working, anything that's working to make me write, I will write. If it's not working, I will get rid of it. That's always the key to whatever I do.
And you can be a streak writer, too, and explain to the audience what that is. What does
that
mean?
I can write really fast at the end. I mean, I've written usually the last, if the book is 400 pages long, and let's say it takes you 9 months, at the 8-month mark, I'll usually be right around page 200. The last month, even faster, I write 200 pages. Usually the last week's 100, and often the last day can be 40 or 50 pages in a row. I write straight through all day. You don't want to hang with me in those days. My kid's like, throw daddy a banana and run. You know, it's that kind of a thing. They don't want to be, I grow a playoff beard like a hockey player. You know, and not to clean up, but it's just a mess, you know. But whatever, so sometimes I will streak that way also. So I don't have one of those 500 word or 1,000 word a day counts. I never do, I don't do word counts. But if it works for you, do them. But for me, it doesn't work. That's normally how I write. And I'm hoping that's going to happen because, as always, I'm behind in my book and I'm panicking that I'll never finish it. And my poor wife has to listen to it and she's trying not to roll her eyes that she hasn't heard this now. This will be my 28th time saying this to her, my 28th novel. And every book, I'm like, this always happens. Now this happens too, but I'll be writing my book going, oh my God, this is so bad. I was so good before. What happened? How did I lose it? And then 5 minutes later, I'll be, this is sheer genius. Someone's going to give this book and never give this work of Shakespearean proportions a chance. And that happens all the time, every
right.
day. Does that happen with you too?
Yeah, and it's really hard to explain to your family that it's like starting over each time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But never, some people compare it to childbirth. You kind of forget the pain.
Yeah.
You know? But women are not looking at me happily right now. It's nothing like childbirth, I know. It's a very stretched analogy.
Tell me about the novel, because we have a lot of families here. Hold Tight.
Mm-hmm.
The premise of which is that some parents decide that the technology available will allow them to kind of watch their troubled child.
Right.
Where did that idea come from?
It came, my wife and I were having dinner with friends, and the guy had convinced their 15-year-old kid was giving them trouble, and they didn't really trust him. And so he put spyware on their computer to monitor everything that the kid did. And part of me was horrified by that, and part of me was like, well, you know, we wouldn't let our kids walk down any street. We wouldn't let our kids see a beheading, and yet they can see one online. Don't we have a responsibility? And as soon as the question becomes interesting, as soon as it's not a black or white issue for me, which is most issues, I love seeing the gray, that's something to write about. I like the grays.
Yeah.
To me, you know, evil and good, it's like the foul line at a baseball game. It's very flimsy, and sometimes fair is foul and foul is fair, especially if you can walk over that lime a bit, you know, with a lime line, if you will, the foul line a bit. And that's where I love to play, and that book was a perfect place for me to play with that, to have. So the book opens up, the parents put spyware on their computer, and a message comes in that their son receives that, again, makes the whole plot explode. And it was fun to explore a lot of different families in that very small environment. And you know, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's all of your stuff. It's true. I was reading The Stranger, couldn't stop, late at night. And just so fascinating, that essence of storytelling, the power of the narrative to transport us. You know, it's magic, isn't it?
Well, thank you. It's magic that it's so flattering when someone says something like that, because that is my dream. I mean, that's my dream. When someone, when I have that feeling, when a writer gives me that feeling, the idea that I give it to somebody else, I don't care how many books you have in print, that's still the most exciting part for
right.
me.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Harlan Coben.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return now to my conversation with novelist Harlan Coben.
Now, you're doing television now.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of work. And it's completely different than the novel writing. Tell us what you're working on.
It's a lot easier, though.
But it's,
I'm doing two TV shows overseas, one in France based on the book No Second Chance. That's done. It's in French, but it should be over here at some point. And I'm working on a British TV show for Sky One that will be over here. I don't know what network yet, but that'll probably be here in January, called The Five, which is 10 episodes long. It's an original idea I had. And basically, it's like taking a novel and breaking it into 10 parts, and it's been a really cool experience. It's hard for me to let go of control, and I love collaborating with people on the one hand. I really do, but at the end of the day, I'm a control freak. You know, I'm used to being the writer, director, actor, everything, key grip. So it's been a very interesting experience.
Yeah, but these are big deals. The French channel is the largest network in Europe, right?
Yeah, no.
And with 8 to 10 million viewers probably per episode. Yeah. So that puts it on par with, in the United States, with CSI or something like that. So that's amazing.
But it's been fun. And the other thing is, you know, the one thing, we write our own books, we do it ourselves, but all of a sudden I have 200 people who are sort of working for me. And they have a budget of, you know, $1 million or $2 million per episode. That's on me. You know, that's, so that's an interesting kind of a thing where you do have other people involved. But at the end of the day, storytelling is storytelling. And one of the reasons I'm doing it over in Europe rather than here is they give me a lot more power to do what I want to do. You know, I cannot stand the network notes. And I don't want to go into the whole Hollywood whine that you hear from a lot of writers, but it's been really fun that so far, knock wood, they've let me kind of do what I want to do and tell the stories I want to tell. Otherwise, you know, I don't have to do this. It's only for fun. It's a new way of telling stories for me.
So you've been through the Hollywood machine as far as trying to pitching stuff and developing it.
They're horrible, horrible, evil, horrendous. I don't want to badmouth them.
They're in the audience, some of them, So 2007 was a big year for you, right? There's a turning point year. Tell No One came out as a movie, or was it 2006?
I think it was six or seven,
I think
an
it was
eight
six.
Year.
Yeah, you wrote, it came that, out here. That novel came out in 2001.
Yeah.
And a French, it was a French production of the movie in 2006. And that it really changed your life. How so?
Well, in France, it certainly changed my life. What happened, originally, this book was bought by Hollywood in 2000. And I don't know how many of you have read the book, Tell No One, but, well, thank you. But the quick 30-second synopsis for those who aren't, basically, I'll tell you how I came up with the idea for Tell No One. That might help. Because most of the time, like, you come up with an idea, it sounds so clean, but it's really messy. It's more like every other those nights, you can't, you know, you're kind of staying awake and you're thinking of weird things. And, you know, you're wondering how you, like, you know, you're starting off thinking, of, like, all of a sudden you can't sleep because you can't remember the name of the dog in Petticoat Junction. You know what I mean? You're just like, the hell is the name of that dog? And then you're wondering how you thought of that, and your thoughts are just bouncing around and actually started off thinking about something completely different, like how come they don't serve Mountain Dew at Burger King, you know, that sort of thing. So it was one of those, but the idea came to me from two different directions. One, I was watching a really bad romance movie. I won't mention the name of the movie, Mestrin Bottle. And what struck me about the movie, and I love Nicholas Sparks, great guy, but what struck me about this movie was it was that story where the man loses, man's wife dies, or the man loses his wife, and he can't go on, and then a hot babe walks by and he's fine. Have you noticed that in these movies, ladies? So I asked myself in those moments, I get serious, what about the man who really lost his soulmate? What about the man who can't go on? Is there a way I can find redemption for him? So I have this part of the idea, and it's over here. The second part of the idea is, I lost my parents at a fairly young age. For those who read the Myron Bolitar novels, that's what I imagine my relationship would be with my parents had they survived. So I know I overwrite them and get too sentimental. Tough, skip them, that's my therapy, okay? So I'm looking at I'm looking at one of those street cams on the computer one day, and I was thinking, you know, the same thing we all do. Wouldn't it be great if my parents could have met my children? Wouldn't it be great if they were still alive? And I thought to myself, what would I do if I right now saw my parents on this webcam? And I took these two ideas and I mashed them together. A man and a woman happily married. The wife is murdered. 8 years pass. He still can't get over her death. He gets an email. He clicks a hyperlink. He sees a webcam. And his dead wife walks by. And the little Homer Simpson part of my brain goes, woohoo. So Hollywood, and this is my one trashing Hollywood story. So Hollywood buys it. And at the time, this was, you know, it was the biggest deal I ever had. All of a sudden, I knew at least one of my kids could go to college. It was a huge deal. And I remember the first meeting with them, they said it was, you know, we just have a few changes, And the big change they want to make is like, well, suppose we get George Clooney to star in this. Who's going to believe that George Clooney wasn't dating for 8 years because of this? Thinking anybody with a beating heart, but okay. So we're going to make it 3 years. I'm like, okay, that's fine. You want to make it 3 years instead of 8 years, that's fine. And also, really, who's going to buy he's not dating? So we gave him a girlfriend. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Only Hollywood, of course, thinks that nobody could really mourn somebody who's dead and never want to date somebody again. So they gave him a girlfriend, so when the other woman came back, it was a love triangle now. And I'm like, you can change everything about it, including moving the whole story to France and have everybody smoke. But you can't do that. So in a very unusual move, I guess, after 3 years, I had the option to get it back. And this crazy French guy named Guillaume Canet is calling me, and I love the movie he had done. And I said to him, you know, I'm so disillusioned with what's going on here. If you can, you know, match the option, I'll give it to you. And I did, and I never looked back or regret it. For those who haven't seen the movie, by the way, it was nominated for 9 Césars, which is their version of the Oscar. And I star in it. I sort of star in it. I'm in it for about 8 seconds. I don't speak. And I stay in the background, but I was brilliant, really. I think I steal the movie. And I think I was robbed, by the way, of that César nomination. I think it's just anti-American feelings still over there. And I stick by that story.
It won,
but that's how it happened. That's how it went over
there. Yeah, it won 4 of those. And then it won the French version of the Golden Globe,
too. Yep, won the Golden Globe. And you can see it. It's on Netflix or Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
It's subtitled, but you'll forget the subtitles.
Yeah, but it's in French.
Are there in 5 minutes. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. It's got a great opening. Here it is. There should have been a dark whisper in the wind, or maybe a deep chill in the bone. Something, an ethereal song only Elizabeth or I could hear, a tightness in the air, some textbook premonition. There is my life now. The two have painfully little in common. It goes on, but it's a really lyrical beginning, thoughtful, well done opening. Do you remember writing that?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, my wife and I at the time had a small lake house on a lake called Lake Elizabeth. Oh. I changed the name of the lake to Lake Charmaine, and I named the character Elizabeth. And I was sitting on the lake, and I was just looking out at it. And it was just a beautiful, quiet spot. And that's when I started to write, you know, that's where I came up with this idea. And the lake had a lot of mystery to it. Part of it had been a summer camp for overweight people like 40, 50 years ago, before this was done. And so as I walked through in like this slightly abandoned cabins. It just got my imagination going. Who could still be here? Could somebody still be living in these cabins? And if you think about it, if you scream in the woods, okay, your voice echoes. That echo never completely goes away. It becomes so minuscule, of course, that no one can ever hear it. But so if somebody screamed there many years ago, you could still, maybe that echo is still around. And I started thinking about that when I wrote that particular opening.
Wow, that's interesting. So from 2000, why did you stop writing the Myron Bolitar series? Because for those of you who don't know, and by the way, all of these books are for sale in the back, and you should pick up at least 3 because you'll read the first the first 2 in 2 days, including the Myron series, which is very funny.
Thank you.
And totally different from what I just read from Tell No One.
Yeah.
And so talk to us about who he is. Is he your alter ego? He's a sports agent.
I don't think Wedder's like to admit this, but Myron started off as me with wish fulfillment. I mean, I'm tall. I was a basketball player. He was a better basketball player. You know, he's smarter. He's funnier. He's stronger. He's more loyal. He's a better friend. I do have him beat in 2 ways. 1, I'm a better dancer. I'll demonstrate later. And and 2, I'm wiser in the ways of women, which is not saying much. We're not talking about 2 geniuses here. We're talking about syphilis being better than gonorrhea. We're talking about, you know. For guys who are not the sharpest. No man is, though, let's face it. As I get older and watch my kids and I watch the women who are their age, my boys, and I'm thinking, oh my God, you're so outclassed. but anyway, I'm lucky I met my wife when I was young, so and Myron, and been so lucky that way. And Myron's love life is a disaster of biblical proportions. But outside, so Myron was sort of me with wish fulfillment, and we ended up having an interesting sort of tension where Myron had what I wanted and I had what Myron wanted. Myron's whole dream in life, if you've read these books, is to get married and live in the burbs and have a barbecue in the yard and have kids, basically what I have. So he's jealous of me. Myron's parents are still alive, as I explained. I'm jealous of him. And this tension worked really, really well for
interesting.
Us. Yeah, it worked really, really. And as our lives went on, what truly has happened, I've written Myron over the course. Myron started the series, I think he's 28. He's now in his 40s. Myron's life has not gone nearly as well as mine.
No. No.
His life, you know, and I say I'll stop the series completely when I know he's happy. You know, when he's happy, that's when the series is over. So people are like, can't you give him, like, when he's happy, it's over.
What's going to make him happy?
That's going to be an interesting question. I don't know. You know, right now, I do look at each, I've written 10 Myron Bolitar books, and I look at them as chapters in a larger novel. I mean, Myron means more to me than the other characters. I'll sell Tell No One to be a movie easily because I'm not writing David Beck again.
Right.
But Myron Bolitar is harder for me because Myron and Wynn and Esperanza and Big Cindy and that whole cast of characters are people I do want to write again and live in my head, will live in my head forever.
Right, so he has this strange sidekick named Wynn who's like, right, he's like the human torpedo or the human hatchet. I mean, he'll just go in and clear a room, right?
Yeah.
And did you know guys like that in college, or I mean, where is that just come out of the other part of your brain, or what?
Well, Wynn is I love sidekick. I mean, Spencer and Hawk, Holmes and Watson, Batman and Robin, and so I wanted that for Myron. I wanted to give Myron a sidekick, but I didn't want the tough ghetto guy had been done. I didn't want the computer nerd had been done, and so I took my college roommate, who has a name equally obnoxious to Windsor Horn.
I knew this was going to be the answer.
Yeah, an Amherst College guy. Looks a little bit like you, quite frankly. Windsor Horn, you know, very good-looking, tall, good-looking guy. You just hated him on sight. And I remember when I first came to Amherst, you know, you get those Facebooks, the real Facebooks, not the one the kids know. Facebook, and I'm paging through it, and I see this guy, and his name is something like Windsor Horn Lockwood III, and he's looking at the camera. And I remember saying to my dad, I'm like, look at this ass. I won't even see him in my 4 years here, nonetheless befriend him, and we ended up being best friends. He was nothing like what he appeared to be, and people hated him on sight because of how he looked. And the real win, you can't make this stuff up, before we'd go out like to a party, to fraternity, he would look in the mirror and go, it must suck to be ugly. So the real Wynn owns a clothing line. He just sold it called, most people I know, Lily Pulitzer, which you can see Wynn owning, bright reds, bright greens. And the first time I'm going to be on national TV is 2002, I think. I'm going to be on with Brian Gumbel. I'm so nervous. And Wynn calls me on the phone and says, oh, you must wear one of my ties when you go on the show. And I'm like, okay, cool. And my publicist goes, oh, my God, those ties, they're really loud. It looks like someone threw up pink and green. And so, you know, Brian will just talk about the tie. Maybe he shouldn't wear the tie. So I call Wynn back, and I said, I might not be able to wear the tie. And he goes, oh, no, you will wear the tie. And I said, no, you're not really Wynn. Because in real life, he can't fight his way out of a paper bag. But I wore the tie. And if you've ever seen me on a Today Show or one of those, I always wear the tie. He sends me the ties every year. And he once came to one of my signings, and I told the story. And I said, by the way, he's in the room. Well, everybody spotted him right away. And he had a longer line to sign books than I did.
Now, I know that Bryant Gumbel used to or still does email you after your books come out.
Yeah, he still does.
Yeah. What does he say?
Like, usually he's mad at me because I'm not a violence in him. Bryant likes the books that are more violent. When I get too tender, he gets angry at me. You know, he wants me to, you know, he didn't shoot enough people in this particular book or whatever. He wants more violence. But no, he's a great friend, and he's a wonderful guy, and he's also completely honest and says whatever's on his mind, which I love in a friend. People say, is he really? It's not that he's a nice guy. He's just always interesting. You know, we'll just bait or argue anything. You know, one time we had like a 2-hour-long debate because he was saying, okay, I'm walking down a hallway in a hotel, it's late at night, someone put out their food tray, I'm really starving, there's a couple fries. Do you eat them or not? And he could be 20 minutes, 2 hours on this. And whatever side you'll take, he'll take the opposite just to get the conversation started. Anyway.
The Bolitar series were mysteries.
Yep.
And this book, The Stranger, and others like it are what, quote, thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
I have no idea.
Okay.
To me, they're no. When I started to write Myron, what I wanted to do is, I had loved like books like Spencer and Raymond Chandler books and all of those sort of great detectives, but I felt that they had great characters, but they lacked a little bit in narrative drive and having a good mystery. And standalones were the opposite for me. They had this great sort of plot, but they didn't have a great character. So in both cases, I've tried to combine them. I tried making the Myron mysteries as strong as the standalones, and the lead characters in the standalones, be it Adam or Kat or Beck or whoever, be as compelling as Myron. That has always been my goal, to marry those two. And I still don't know what the difference is between a thriller and a mystery.
But you don't plot, I mean, really,
right,
in any kind of extensive way. Right.
I hope the books. No, I don't plan it out.
Well, you have plot, but
I don't plan it out.
You don't plan it out. You're not.
I know the beginning and the end. I know very little in between.
Wow. Yeah. And what are you working while you're here in Traverse City?
No, I haven't really.
So you're behind.
What's that?
You're behind.
I'm. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Like I don't feel guilty enough. I live with guilt, so I don't feel guilty enough right now. But thanks. Yeah.
No, it's amazing. You seem to be one of those people that actually the pressure builds and then you actually live on it. You live on that edge and you just get going and it starts to drive the narrative. And the humor, the difference between, if you haven't tried the Volatar series, do that and pick up, say, Tell No One, The Stranger, and a couple of, like, what would you recommend on the Volatar for someone to start?
I don't know, Long Lost, Promise Me, Fade Away is a good one to start. I'm the worst person to ask, you know. Some people say read them in order, but I don't think the first one or two are that good because I hate all my old books, like all writers do.
Now, is Play Dead, published in 1990, that a Volatar novel?
No, it's not. It's terrible. Years I wouldn't let it back into print, and finally the French publisher really kind of made me an offer I couldn't refuse, but I made a deal with them. I said, the only way I'll let this book back in print is if you let me put a letter in the front saying, dear reader, okay, this is the first book of mine you're reading. Please put it back. I'll wait. It's not really that good. It's my first book. I got better later on. If you're a completist, read it, but otherwise don't. And I said I wanted to put this letter that I had written in the front of both Play Dead and Miracle Cure if we were going to allow them to be re-released. And publishers, of course, freaked out and said no, but they all ended up doing it. And no one was discouraged by that in the end. It was almost like I challenged you. Like, oh, I'll see if it's that bad. So it didn't really have much effect. But we all, I compared the old books. It's like all of you, maybe you wrote a paper in college you thought was brilliant, right? And you find it now and you read it and go, wow, what was I thinking? This is horrendous because you've changed. And so it's hard. I don't read my old books. When I did No Second Chance, the TV show in France this last year, I had to go back and read it. And it was the first time I had read it in 12 years. And it was really hard.
Hours a week do you think you work with the two television shows, which you created on our show running, and now I'm working on the novel?
I don't know. And also, a lot of mine is just in my head by myself. When I sit down to write, for the most part, it's sort of already written in my head. I'm really bad company. I'm distracted. You know, my friends know, oh, he's going a lot. I look off a lot. I don't pay attention, because in my head, I'm always sort of working on some sort of plot. It's part of just, you know, who you are. You think about the book a lot more than you should.
Right, and you don't just sit down and work. As we near the end here, what story do you think you're telling? Because you are so popular and I think relevant readable and you know, a lot of things, but you must be hitting a chord that Americans are responding to. And I often wonder, what is that story that we're telling? Do you ever ponder when you?
I don't really. I'm very grateful for it. You know, the introduction was kind enough to mention 43 languages. I actually sell more books overseas than I sell here altogether. And so I think I'm writing about the American dream, but it's really the world dream. It's what we sort of all really want. We want peace, harmony. We want that sort of family life. We want it to go well. And where you have a dream come true, it can turn to a nightmare. Where you have something that's fragile, it can break. And so I read a lot about hope. And that's why I have people disappear, not die, in most of my books. Because if somebody dies or dead, you're solving a crime. But hope can make your heart sore, or it can crush it like an eggshell. And that's sort of what I think each book, if I had one word to describe what the books are about, they're about hope, I hope.
Yeah.
I hope they're about hope. But mostly, it's really important to me that I entertain you. I mean, that might be old-fashioned sounding. I don't write for myself. I don't believe anybody who does. I think that's nonsense. I write you know, as you remember, I'm on, if any writer comes on the stage and says this, you have my permission to boo them. When a writer says, oh, I write only for myself, I don't care if anyone reads it. That's like saying, I talk only to myself. I don't care if anyone listens. From the beginning of time, it's really about, you know, I was lucky enough, I don't know if he's here tonight, but we were lucky enough to eat with Mario Batali this week, who's one of your great residents, and one of the reasons that we are here is how much he sells this place and says how wonderful this place is. And I was thinking, Mario made us this amazing dinner, and literally the best pulled pork I've ever eaten in my life. And I was asking about how, you know, how he made it, and he was describing to me he has to get a certain part of the shoulder, and he has to have it marinated for at least exactly a week, and then he has to smoke it, and all of the work that goes into it. So it's one of these things I wonder about, creation versus the process. I mean, but I think for Mario, if he doesn't see a reaction to this food he creates, did he even cook? Did it really exist? And it's the same thing for me as a writer. There's a great saying, I don't like writing, I like having written.
Right.
Without a reader, I'm not a writer. A writer without a reader is a man who claps with one hand. Mario makes that food, you're the other hand. And Mario makes that food and nobody eats it. And so you kind of, people want to admit this, you live for that reaction. When you write your books, you want people to be educated by what you've done. You want them to be entertained and you want them to be enlightened. You don't have to necessarily see that reaction, but you have to feel there's a reaction. Otherwise, I'm playing a game of catch, I'm throwing the ball out there and no one's catching it. The reader is that catcher, or the person who's dining is that catcher. I was thinking about that when I was watching how Mario prepared this thing, mm-hmm. And it goes for all that mm-hmm. sort of stuff.
It's interesting. I just was looking. Now, Livewire came out in 2011. And then there was a book previous to that, mm-hmm. And then there was one in 12. And so what I'm getting at here is, how did 9/11 affect you? We've just talked about, you think you write about hope.
Right.
Where were you on that day, and how did that affect the arc of the American dream that you've just projected for us?
It was, other than personal family tragedy or whatever, it was the worst day of my life. I mean, our town lost a lot of people. I would say for a long time, we never went more than a day or two without seeing a kid who no longer had a father, or a woman, a wife who no longer had her husband. Every day, our town was hit really, really badly
wow.
by it. And I still can't write about it, but it's on every page
yeah.
after that. Because it's sort of like, if you're writing a book in 1971, the Vietnam War may not be mentioned. I know your new book is writing about the Vietnam War, but it's on every page. And so it changed everything. I remember the thing I remember the most was we all went to school to pick up our kids, and we, what husbands came home and which didn't. And the ones who weren't yet home never came home. You had this hope at the time that they would be okay. The ones that were gone right away, and then for a while you would drive around town and you would see a house that had too many cars parked in front of it. And you knew why. And it was a really tough time. And I didn't write for quite a while after that. And when I did, I'm like, there's no way I can do it. But finally, about two books later, I had a person driving, because I had this experience. I was driving the New Jersey Turnpike, and I used to always look to the right when I was driving north, and I could see the two towers. And then for a while afterwards, I didn't see the two towers, but I knew exactly where they were. And then one day, about 3 years afterwards, I was driving, and I looked to the right, and I didn't remember where the towers were. And I got so angry at myself. And that's when I said, now that's part of the book in some way without being in the book.
Right.
Well, wow, it really brought us down. Hey, how about those Knicks?
I think, Harlan, would you mind, thank you for that answer, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
Because I do think it's there.
Yeah.
And I do think that, but I didn't know that answer.
Yeah.
I know you have something, I'd love for you to read.
Oh, yeah.
The essay, and this was published.
It was the op-ed page in New York Times this last Thanksgiving. They had called me. I write op-ed pages maybe once a year. Sometimes I give them a suggestion. Like one time I did snacking, like the school. You know when you go to your kid's soccer game and you have to bring snacks? It's like, what the hell is that all about? And if you don't bring a cool snack, you're an uncool parent. And it's like these kids are running around for an hour. They don't have to have like Ho-Hos and Twinkies and this kind of juice cartons that have enough sugar to coat a Honda Odyssey. And So I wrote a rant about that. But normally, sometimes they call me. And in this case, they called and they said they wanted me to write about a lonely time during the holidays. So with that, it's very short, don't worry. I hate long readings. Thanksgiving weekend in 1990, I spent 2 hours at the loneliest place in the world for an obscure novelist, the book signing table at a Walden Books in a suburban New Jersey mall. I sat at the table smiling like a game show host. Store patrons scurried past me, doing all they could to avoid contact. I kept smiling. I straightened out my pile of free bookmarks for the umpteenth time, though so far none had been taken. I played with my pen. Authors at signings like this get good at playing with their pens. I pushed it to and fro. I curled my upper lip around the pen and made it into a makeshift mustache. I clipped it to my lower lip, pinching said lip in an almost masochistic way, and is able to click the pen open by moving my jaw and pressing it against my nose. You can't teach that skill, by the way. Practice. At one point, I took out a second pen, I rolled up a spitball, and then let the two pens play hockey against each other. The rollerball beat the Sharpie in overtime. During the first hour of my signing, a grand total of 4 people approached me. 2 asked me where the bathroom was. The 3rd explained his conspiracy theory linking the JFK assassination with the decision by General Mills to add crunch berries to Captain Crunch breakfast cereal. The 4th asked me if we had a copy of the new Stephen King. I kept smiling. 4 copies of my brand spanking new first novel, Walden Books New, not to order too many, stood limply on the shelf behind me. I missed the Barker Lounger in my den. I longed for home and hearth, for stuffing my face with leftover turkey, for half-watching football games in which I had no rooting interest. Instead, I slow-baked under the fluorescent Walden book lights, the early hipster booksellers glaring at me as though I was some kind of pedantic squatter. I had become the literary equivalent of a poster child. You could buy his book, or you could turn the page. Time didn't just pass slowly. It seemed to be moonwalking backwards. Then, with maybe 15 minutes left before I could scrape up the scraps of my dignity and head home, an old man shuffled toward me. He wiped his nose with what I hoped was a beige hanky. His eyes were runny. Odds were this is going to be a where's the bathroom question, but this guy had all the makings of another conspiracy theorist. The old man's gaze drifted over my shoulder. What's that like? Excuse me? That's your novel, right? He gestured at the 4 books at the shelf behind me. Right, I said. He shook his head in awe. That's my dream, man. Seeing my book on a shelf in a bookstore. He lowered his gaze and met my eye. So what's that like? I paused, letting the question sink in. But before I could reply, the old man lifted his eyes back to the bookshelf, smiled, and shook his head again. Lucky, he said before turning and walking away. He didn't buy a book. He didn't have to. Thank you.
That was Harlan Coben talking with Doug Standen. Coben's latest book is The Stranger. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.